Hi, this is Lou Mangiello from loumangiello.com, and I'm the host of the WDW Radio podcast, and you are listening to the Marketing to Crush Your Competitors podcast.
If you want to join a great community of entrepreneurs, serious and ambitious entrepreneurs, I invite you to join our Facebook group called Serious Entrepreneurs Only, and it will be my pleasure to answer your questions, and you will get support from entrepreneurs from all over the world sharing their insights, their experience, strategy, and expertise with you. So looking forward to connect with you there. Marketing to Crush Your Competitors podcast, episode 163.
This is the place where successful entrepreneurs share their hustle to get where they are today. Discover how not taking no for an answer led them to achieve their goals. Learn about who inspired them and how they use marketing to crush it in their business. Get financial, spiritual, emotional, and physical tips that are working for them right now. This is the Marketing to Crush Your Competitors podcast. Here's Fabienne Raphael.
All for listening. This is another episode of Marketing to Crush Your Competitors podcast. Today, my guest is Mitch Russo. Mitch is a growth consultant, CEO coach, and business strategist at MindfulGuidance.com. His expertise is broad, from creating virtual organizations and coaching networks to building, growing, running, selling, and buying technology companies. And Mitch is a best-selling author with his latest book, The Invisible Organization. Mitch, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Fabian. Delighted to be here.
Well, I read about you, and I know that you had six careers so far. And I'm curious to know why so, Mitch. Is it because you were so, or you are so versatile as a person, or it's because it took you some time to find your true calling in life?
So you asked me why I've had six careers, and you asked me if you thought it was because maybe I wasn't focused or searching for my true thing. And I think all six of them have been a progression in my life. I think they've led me to where I am. And I don't think any of them were a distraction in any way or in any way unimportant or unnecessary. They were all really part of my progression to being who I am today.
And also, I didn't necessarily mean that you were not focused, because sometimes some people are very talented and good at very, like, a lot of things. So I thought that was your case.
Yeah, I don't think I'm that talented. I think because the reason I say that is because if I have any talent, it's in following my passion and getting focused. And when I am not focused and I'm not following my passion, then I'm not having fun and I'm not making money and I'm not helping others. And so that's, to me, everything I've done has been really those three things.
I know, Mitch, that you had the great honor to share friendship with Chet Holmes. So would you tell us, what is your biggest takeaway from his mentoring or his friendship?
That's such a gift, that friendship. I'll tell you a little bit about how I got to know Chet.
Yeah.
When I first started TimeSlips Corporation, which was a software company I started in 1985, we entered the legal market with time and billing software. And Chet was working for Charlie Munger, who was one of the owners of the publication that he worked for. And Chet was selling advertising. And Chet had targeted his top 100 possible clients, and I was one of them. And, you know, when Chet approached me to advertise in his magazine, I wasn't that interested. In fact, I really wasn't even that friendly. I turned him down. I said, no, thanks, and probably hung up on the guy, because that's really sometimes how I treated salespeople back in that era, when I was being bombarded with sales calls all the time. So, but he was persistent, and he didn't give up, and he really got to understand me and know the company. And the more he called, at first I was annoyed, but then later I was fascinated by this guy who just would not give up. And eventually we just started having these really deep conversations, and I became his friend. And this goes back to 1985, and we made friends. And eventually, about a year and a half later, I finally did advertise with Chet, and we made a lot of money together. So it was great experience doing that. But we what lasted more than the advertising was the friendship. And that friendship lasted all throughout the years after I sold the company and as I entered my next phase, which was running an internet startup for a venture capital company. And Chet was a part of my life all those years until one day he reached out and he said, you know, I'd love for you to come and help me here at Chet Holmes International. And I said, geez, that sounds like a great opportunity. What do you want me to do? And so we started chatting about what I would do. And the first thing I did was I began recruiting salespeople for him.
Yeah.
So that's how I met him. And so to answer your question about the greatest takeaway, I think that Chet was a no limits person. And what I mean by no limits is that there was really nothing that he couldn't accomplish, couldn't do, or he would let stop him in his quest to have, be, and do everything that he wanted to be in his life. And that's what I got from my friendship with him. That's what I got from him as a person. And it brought a dimension to me that I didn't have before.
And do you try, like when you are with coaching clients or working with CEOs, do you try to transmit that also to those people?
You know, I don't do it consciously, but I think it happens naturally.
Yeah.
I just think it's part of my DNA at this point. And you know, it's like, for example, I have a client who I just coached through an entire trade show setup because I have a lot of experience with trade shows. And, you know, she actually had a bad experience at the trade show. And what I needed to do is reinforce what good came out of that experience. And we talked a lot about the fact that, you know, she ended up with 100 leads. You know, it was absolutely a terrific trade show from my perspective. Yeah. And I helped shift her perspective on that, just as I think Chet would have too. And at the same time, I said, listen, this is just the very first in many trade shows you're going to do. So even though you don't think you did well and you don't think you got as much out of it as you wanted, I think you did and you learned a lot. So to me, it was a total win. So I would say there's the type of attitude that that I have today merely as a result of being and knowing my friend Chet.
You said when you were explaining how you met Chet and how you got to work with him that you started part-time helping him recruit salespeople.
Yes.
And actually, you started at a bottom and you fought your way and you proved that you deserved to get where you wanted to be. So do you find that today people or maybe younger generations have forgotten that sometimes you got to show what you're worth before getting the big contract? Or should everybody go big right at the beginning?
I mean... It's such a great question, Fabian. I have to tell you, I really think that it's almost impossible to have mastery in something unless you start at the bottom. I mean, I don't care how much you study. I don't care how much you learn from books. But without mentorship and experience, and sometimes that experience comes at a price, meaning you may have to work for free or at a low price, or you may have to work in situations that you don't enjoy to get that experience. But I don't know, really, I'm not sure if young people think that they're entitled, as I think some do. I think young people do get it, though. I think they know and they're preparing for their own lives. They know how hard it is now to get jobs and to keep them, being how fluid the work environment is. So I really do think people get it. I think they have to, that people know they have to start at the bottom and work their way up.
Yeah, let's hope everybody get it.
Exactly.
As I said, I prepared for this interview and read about you, and you say one of your biggest strengths is your creativity.
Yes.
So I want you to give us a situation where you really thought there was no exit and where your creativity saved you.
Okay. Well, probably the most famous one of all is the story of my software company. And when I was a salesman and I was selling semiconductor parts to industry many years ago in the early 80s, I had bought a personal computer, one of the first PCs that came out from IBM. And interestingly enough, came the end of the year, I claimed that purchase on my tax return, and my accountant said that I couldn't. And I said, why can't I claim this? It's a product I'm using for my business. It's a business expense. And he says, well, the IRS thinks that computers are toys, and the only way you can claim it is if you have contemporaneous record keeping of its usage. And that's a fancy way of saying that you got to keep track of everything you do.
Wow.
So I said, okay, I'll figure out, I'll find a piece of software that keeps track of everything I do. And I looked and I looked and I searched and I couldn't find one. And one morning at breakfast with my neighbor, I was expressing my frustration at this problem that there was no software to keep track of everything I did on my computer. And I suggested that, hey, you know, this might be something, this might be a product that we could sell or something like that. And to my shock and delight, about 5 weeks later, he called me up to his office next door to me because we were next door neighbors. And he said, I want to show you something. And he had built a tiny little software program that would actually allow me to keep track of everything as I did it and time it as well. And great. I was shocked. I said, oh my God, that's fantastic. Let's get this ready and let's create a software company to sell this. And he said, fantastic, let's do it. So at that point, we worked hour after hour. Oh, I had to work every day. So I would come home from work and I would go over to his house and we would work together on defining the product. And I would be beta testing the software and writing the manual. And we spent all this time and then we quit our jobs. Well, I quit my job and we ready to launch the software. And guess what happens next?
It was a success.
Wrong. The IRS relaxed their rulings on record keeping, and all that work was for nothing.
It was not, actually, because you helped other people.
No, nobody ever got to see that product because nobody ever needed it, because no longer did you have to keep track of your time for IRS purposes. So we were bummed. I mean, we were like really bummed. We'd both, you know, really made sacrifices to start this company and invested money and all this other stuff. So we sat together and we brainstormed for 2 solid hours. And some people would say, wow, it only took 2 hours. Well, it felt like an eternity. But in that moment, we came up with the idea of converting what we did to keep track of time for clients. And that was the birth of TimeSlips. So it
was. I love that story.
So it was taking something that would have been an absolute disaster. And I mean, worst case, we didn't think of anything to do. We invested all this time and money. We would have thrown it all away. I would have had to go out and find another job and you know, feel like a failure and all that other stuff. But instead, what we did is, because of creativity, we were able to take a bad situation, which ultimately was a gateway to a huge opportunity, which we were able to take advantage of.
Mm-hmm. And do you think, Mitch, that this is a lesson to a lot of people that maybe, yes, hit the wall, for example, in an idea or a business venture or something that happened, and then they think that this is it, this is the end of it? Should we always take time to reevaluate everything and see if there's a way to twitch something or to repurpose it or just to see if that idea can actually live?
Yeah, well, see, I'm a believer in that, and it's how I lived my life. And a nice thing about it is my ex-partner, Neil Ayer, had a saying. He was Buddhist, or he loved Buddhist practices. And one of the things he used to say to me is, you know, everything is perfect the way it is. And we used to have arguments about this because I would say, well, then what's the point of trying if everything's perfect the way it is? My goal is to change the way it is. And his point was that, well, that's right. And because you can change everything, that's the way it is. And therefore, it's perfect. So over the years, I started to integrate his way of thinking. And so sometimes when failure happens and you have this thought, it's perfect the way it is. Now use it. Now take that failure and turn it into, have it become the alchemy of your success. Convert it. Mm-hmm. And that to me is the beauty of having this gift of creativity. But we all have that gift. It's just a matter of applying it.
Yes. So would you mind then giving a tip to someone that thinks that don't have any creativity?
Okay. So my belief is that, you know, the old saying that not everyone is an artist, but everyone is an artist in their own special way. And to me, that's exactly what I believe about creativity. Everybody is creative in their own special way. And it's all about finding how our creativity can become part of our passion and drive us to really experience the joy and success that we want in life. Mm.
And I love that. Let's switch into your last book now, The Invisible Organization. It was the number one bestseller on Amazon. And it shows how companies all over the world could greatly benefit from moving part or even all their staff to work from home as virtual employees. So here, Mitch, I'll be dramatic. My question is, would you say then that this is the future of all businesses and that one day all offices will disappear?
I'm going to answer that question with a story.
Okay.
I've had a lot of consulting clients over the years. I had IBM as a consulting client once, and I was invited to their headquarters in Armonk. And I remember touring their headquarters and experiencing the fact that this entire building, I think the whole property was 2 million square feet. And as I walked through the property, it was so obvious to me that it was empty. There was nobody there practically. And I turned to my host, the gentleman who had brought me into the company. I said, "Hey, where is everybody?" And he said, "Well, I mean, you know, most people are working from home." And this was back in 2009. Everybody was working from 2008, maybe. Everybody was working from home. Back then, IBM and many companies have been doing this for years. Mm-hmm. And what ends up happening is that, I mean, they built those facilities before there was the ability to work from home. I mean, computers are around a while, certainly, but the internet and you know, networks outside of your organization were rare in the early 1990s even. So ultimately, what started to happen was that as soon as those things started to emerge, companies like IBM took advantage of that and started sending people home for all the advantages that working from home brings, both to the corporation and to the employee. So you ask me if it's the future. I say it's inevitable. I say that it almost doesn't make sense anymore to envision a business that doesn't have some part or all of the staff working from their own homes. It doesn't make sense unless you have a place of business where you serve walk-in clients like a barbershop or a meat market or, you know, some retail environment.
Yeah. So why then, how easy or how hard would you say it is for a company or an organization to bring all their business virtually?
Well, it all depends on how you started. I mean, today, younger folks get this intuitively. They already are, for the most part, immersed online. So they don't have a problem with this. In fact, they embrace it. And many of those folks start their own companies naturally as a virtual company. And then later may add an office or two as they need. Mm-hmm. Older folks like me and those of us who have grown up in the, you know, throughout the 80s and 90s have brick and mortar companies and never really learned to understand how companies can work virtually. Or maybe they have a little bit of experience with it, but not a lot. You see, it's those guys now who have the greatest benefit and are also in the greatest danger of losing their business. Mm-hmm. So
and what? Yeah, go ahead.
So I was going to say that those people that the reason that they're in danger of losing their own business is because entrepreneurs are not really looking for new business ideas. They're looking to solve problems that existing businesses have.
Yes.
So they'd be young people be happy to come in and completely take over your industry and do it in the modern way through cloud computing versus the way you've done it.
And what would you say then is the biggest advantage? For example, if you go in an organization that wants actually to be organized virtually, like most of it or part of it, what's the best advantage, or what's the best statistic or fact that you bring up to them to show them that, hey, this is the way to go?
Well, what I do is I use the book to make a case for virtually everything we've discussed. So the book describes, first of all, what the mindset of the CEO must be before the company can even begin to think about going virtual. Then the book gets into the benefits of going virtual, such as almost every virtual company or every company that becomes virtual can generate more profits. They can generate more client satisfaction. The staff who work for that company would be much happier working from home than having to sit on the highway in traffic every day and spend money on gas and waste time. So the benefits are so outweighing the disadvantages of going invisible and going virtual that most people see it intuitively. Now, the book is designed to help CEOs who already have companies or who are planning to get through the challenges of organizing and structuring their business so it can easily convert to a virtual organization.
Mm. All right, Mitch. So to end that up here, I'm curious to know, what's your own definition of the word success?
Well, that's a great question. I think, and I'll reflect on what I tell my daughter. My daughter is a junior in college, and you know, all her life I told her to follow her dreams. And you know, I didn't tell her to become an accountant. I said, follow your dreams, and from that, your career will come. And she started out singing in school and became, you know, an award-winning singer throughout her high school career. And then as she was ending her high school career, she published her first book, and which is on Amazon right now. And she ended up at Lesley University because of having published that book, and is now the author of two other books as well. So
wow.
I don't know what a success is for you, but I know for me, a success is living a self-determined life. That doesn't mean it has to be easy, but it has to be self-determined. I want to define and decide what I do and where I go, and I want to seek the most enjoyment out of life through helping others.
Hmm. And that's so well said, Mitch. Lately, I read on the Huffington Post a post that was written by Alicia Keys, the singer.
Yes.
And she was actually very authentic and sharing how since she was younger, because she was gifted or talented, she realized that a lot of people were, let's say, pointing her with the finger, and she started to see it as a disadvantage. So she started to hide herself, like not necessarily be true to herself and express herself the way she truly is. And your definition makes me think so much of that article, because you're saying you want to make sure that what you're doing today is your own decision and it's your own calling and it's who you truly are. And I think it's wonderful that you say that, because I think nowadays still a lot of people live the life of someone that wants them to live that certain type of life, but not their own life.
You're so right. And you know, once again, what it comes down to is, in the end, if you live your life to please others, then you've never pleased yourself. Mm. And a life lived having pleased another person means that you didn't get to decide what you wanted out of life and what ultimately makes you happy. So mm-hmm. you can't, I don't understand how anyone could do that. Yet at the same time, I know that many of us are sort of feeling trapped in a situation where they have to. And to me, that's sad because I don't believe anybody really has to. I think ultimately people get the chance to live the life that they choose. And, you know, sometimes it's hard. It's hard to live a life. It's hard to decide to do what you want when in the face of everybody telling you what they think you should do, parents, teachers, college professors, guidance counselors, all telling you what they think you should do. And, you know, in the end, it doesn't any of that matter. What only matters is what you choose to do, what you decide to do, and how you want to do it. So my philosophy and the philosophy I've taught my daughter is serve yourself first. And that doesn't mean be selfish. It doesn't mean, you know what I mean? It doesn't mean take away from others. It just means make sure you're taking care of yourself.
Yes, you're so right about that. So if people want to know more about you, connect with you, and talk about that with you, Mitch, where should they go?
Well, let's see. There's several places. Probably the best place to start is if they want to get my book, they can go to invisibleorganization.com, www.invisibleorganization.com. If they want to connect with me more directly, they can go to mitchrusso.com. And what I thought I would do, Fabian, is I'd like to tell you what my favorite quote in the whole world is.
Oh, go ahead.
It's by Steve Jobs, and I'm going to read it to you. Okay. Your time is limited, so don't waste it living someone else's life. Don't be trapped by dogma, which is living with the results of other people's thinking. Don't let the noise of others' opinions drown out your own inner voice. And most important, have the courage to follow your heart and intuition. They somehow already know what you truly want to become. Everything else is secondary. Steve Jobs.
It's so true, Mitch. Thank you so much for sharing that with us.
My pleasure.
And thank you so much for being on the show. That was great. I love this interview.
Me too. And thanks for inviting me on your show. And I look forward to hearing it in your podcast.
All right. Thanks for your loyalty. Thanks for listening to the show week after week. Thanks for sending great reviews for my show. And thanks for sending me emails with great insights, guests that you appreciate, people you would love to hear on the show. Well, let me tell you and ask you a question. If there's anybody in particular you would like to hear on the show, well, I invite you to tweet me at Fabienne Raphael. That's at FabienneRaphael. And I'll try to connect with that person and see if they would be willing to be on the show just to serve you better. So thanks again for your presence, and I'll talk to you next week. Take care.